The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how brain size may predict video game success. Are we talking about overall brain size here, Dave?
Actually, Rob, we're talking about a specific region of the brain known as the striatum. And this is a region that's been implicated in tasks like learning and memory.
Tasks presumably important for video game playing, too?
Well, tasks important for life, obviously, but also important for video games, specifically in this case, a video game called Space Fortress, which you probably have never heard of.
Indeed, I have not.
And for good reason. It's a very basic game. In fact, it's so basic, it was actually developed in the early 1980s. And it looks like those very early arcade games where there's a spaceship and there's a fortress, but the ship and the fortress basically just look like geometrical shapes. We're not talking about Halo or any other fancy game here. This is a very basic game, but believe it or not, it's actually also a very complicated game. Players that play it have to dodge enemies, and a lot of times the enemies look the same as the good guys, and they're trying to destroy this fortress while they're dodging enemies, and their ship also has no brakes, so it's flying around all around the screen. So it's a deceptively complex game, even though it looks like a pretty simple game. You can actually see a screenshot of the game on the site. Anyways, researchers have used this game for decades now to test various skills in humans. We talked about learning and memory, but also skills like motor control, which you would imagine would be really important for playing a video game. And video games tend to be pretty straightforward ways for researchers to test these abilities in humans rather than having to go out in their daily lives and perform these tasks. Researchers can have people play games and monitor them while they're playing the games. And what they've noticed with this game specifically is that when people play it, they seem to be using this striatum region of the brain. And the researchers wondered, you know, is there something specific about the striatum? Is it something as basic as, you know, a larger striatum would allow people to play the game better and a smaller striatum would cause them to play it worse? Just a simple question like that. And that's what the researchers asked in this study.
So what was the correlation?
Well, what the researchers did was they actually looked at a bunch of college students. They looked at about 40 male and female college students, and they found that indeed those students with larger striatums tended not only to pick up the game much faster, they learned how it worked much faster, but they also performed a lot better at the game than students that had these smaller, relatively smaller striatums.
But the brain does change, right? I mean, are we saying that the larger striatum means they're better video game players, or perhaps because they've played so many video games, they just have larger striatums?
Well, it's a really good question, Rob. And there's actually kind of a chicken and egg scenario going on here, because one idea is some people are just born with larger striatums and that just makes them naturally better learners or, you know, better multitaskers or whatever. But perhaps it's the other way around. Perhaps we're all sort of born with a striatum around the same size, but that those of us who practice a lot, you know, either via video games or some other activity, can actually build the size of our striatum. And that is why the researchers are seeing this correlation. So not enough information in this study to figure out exactly what's going on. At this point, it's just sort of a neat association between finding that a particular size of a region of the brain is correlated with the ability to play a video game better.
Okay, so what other stories have we brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, this next story has to do with another difference between humans, and this is a difference in our ability to deal with alcohol. And this is talking about our ability to deal with drinking even one glass of red wine.
Even one glass?
Even one glass. This story has to do with something called Asian flush, and it's called that because about 50% of Asians, when they drink alcohol, their face gets really red, and sometimes they even feel nauseous, or they just feel really bad. And this only happens to about 5% of Europeans or people with European ancestry. And it turns out the difference has to do with this mutation in a type of gene called an alcohol dehydrogenase. And basically what these genes do is they produce enzymes that help break down alcohol in the body. And when people have this mutation, they actually break down alcohol super fast, sometimes 100 times faster than normal. And what that causes, it causes a lot of these breakdown products to accumulate in the blood. And these breakdown products can cause the capillaries in the face to dilate, which causes the face to turn really red and also has other effects, like just not making you feel very well. And because of this, a lot of Asians actually don't drink alcohol because they don't like the experience. And researchers, you know, even though they know what genetically caused this, they didn't know why this mutation cropped up in the first place. You know, a lot of times when you have something, whether it be sickle cell anemia or some other mutation, it arose for a certain reason. Like with sickle cell, it seems to have arisen to protect people from malaria. And the researchers wondered, did something similar happen here? Was there a reason Asians specifically in large numbers seem to have developed this mutation that pretty much made them allergic to alcohol?
So a reason for the propagation of the mutation.
Exactly. So what the researchers did in this study was they looked at over 2,000 people all across China, because, again, the mutation seems to be largely confined to Asians. And they looked at a whole bunch of different ethnic groups and geographical areas. And what they noticed is that the highest prevalence of this mutation seemed to be occurring in geographical areas where archaeologists know that rice was first domesticated. And rice is important because rice can be fermented to make alcohol. So that was one indication that maybe this mutation has some sort of link to rice farming. And then the researchers did some tricky genetic math, and they found out that the mutation arose about 7,000 to 10,000 years ago. And this also correlates very nicely with when it's thought that rice was first domesticated. So that was another strong piece of evidence that maybe the mutation was linked to rice somehow. And the researchers have a couple other sort of more ancillary pieces of evidence. There's evidence that way back then, the Chinese farmers were actually using rice to make alcohol. So it was technically possible, and there's evidence they were actually doing it. Basically, what all this adds up to is the idea that these early rice farmers, when they first started cultivating rice, they were making alcohol from the rice, but there was a danger in making alcohol, or there was a danger in consuming a lot of alcohol. So that those farmers with this mutation would have been sort of much better off, because they would have very quickly stopped drinking alcohol, or maybe even drunk it in real moderation. And the idea is that that's what caused the propagation of this mutation, especially among Asians.
So the selective pressure for this mutation continuing on was that it kept farmers from drinking too much?
That's essentially what they're arguing.
What are other researchers saying about this?
Well, other researchers say that this is still really a correlation at this point. The researchers don't really have direct evidence that this is what caused the mutation to propagate in the first place. For one thing, we're talking about a big time range here. 7,000 years to 10,000 years ago is when researchers thought this mutation cropped up, and that's a lot of variability. And the researchers also say that, you know, there were also grapes being cultivated around this time, and so it's possible that there is no rice connection at all, but there may still be an alcohol connection making wine from grapes, and that's what caused the mutation to propagate in the first place. So there's still a few question marks here. But, you know, scientists say this is an important study also because it really adds to this growing body of research showing how strong of a role human culture really played in human evolution.
Okay. So last story, what's this last one about?
Well, Rob, speaking of evolution, perhaps nothing is more important to evolution than passing on traits. And what helps males pass on traits? Sperm. This last story is about how sperm compete with each other to get to the egg.
Well, sure, they're all trying to get there first.
Right, but in most cases when we think about sperm trying to get the egg, it almost doesn't really matter who gets there first because all the sperm ostensibly came from the same male. But there are some species, particularly certain species of mice, where a female will mate with several males in rapid succession. So she's got a bunch of sperm from different males inside her, and they're all competing with each other to get to the egg. So in that case, it does matter which sperm gets to the egg because only one of those males can be the father.
So how are they competing?
Well, Rob, what researchers have noticed is that the sperm seem to team up with each other. And actually, when a bunch of sperm team up and they're all swimming, they can actually swim a lot faster than the sperm that haven't teamed up and get to the egg a lot faster. And researchers had already sort of observed this before, but they didn't know if the sperm actually knew who to team up with. And so in this study, researchers fluorescently labeled sperm from various males, and they added the sperm to a dish, and they wanted to see, can these sperm figure out which other sperm to hook up with? And indeed, they found out that sperm, especially from a mouse called deer mice, which is a highly promiscuous type of mouse, the researchers saw that the sperm, even if they mixed them all together from different males, the sperm were somehow able to recognize that they were from the same male. Even sperm that were from two closely related males, so say sperm from two brother mice, avoided each other. They only associated and only hooked up with sperm from the same male. So the researchers don't know exactly how this is happening yet. They fear there's some sort of genetic fingerprint that the sperm are using to identify each other. So that's the step that still has to be figured out. In the meantime, experts are saying this result makes a lot of sense. We already know that microbes can recognize each other and help each other out. And, you know, obviously this happens on a much larger scale as well. So it only makes sense that sperm should be able to help each other out as well. And that's what researchers seem to be seeing here.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got stories about how near-Earth encounters can shake up asteroids, and also how the Cold War affected the movement of bird species, specifically invasive bird species, in Europe. And on the science policy blog, Science Insider, we've got a story about the new senator elected for Massachusetts, Scott Brown, and what his election may mean for climate change policy in the U.S., and also a story about the future of the International Space Station. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.